We're reading this evening, please, from chapter 21 and a few verses from chapter 22, the book of the Revelation, chapter 21. At verse 1, "And I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth were passed away, and there was no more sea. And I, John, saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down from God out of heaven, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a great voice out of heaven saying, Behold, the tabernacle of God is with men, and he will dwell with them, and they shall be his people, and God himself shall be with them, and be their God. And God shall wipe away all tears from their eyes. There shall be no more death, neither sorrow nor crying, neither shall there be any more pain, for the former things are passed away. And he that sat upon the throne said, Behold, I make all things new." Verse 10, "And he carried me away in the spirit to a great and high mountain, and showed me that great city, the holy Jerusalem, descending out of heaven from God, having the glory of God, and her light was like unto a stone most precious, even like a jasper stone, clear as crystal, and had a wall great and high, and had 12 gates, and at the gates 12 angels, and names written thereon, which are the names of the 12 tribes of the children of Israel." Verse 14, "The wall of the city had 12 foundations, and in them the names of the 12 apostles of the Lamb. And he that talked with me had a golden reed to measure the city, and the gates thereof, and the wall thereof. And the city lieth four square, and the length is as large as the breadth. And he measured the city with the reed, 12,000 furlongs, the length and the breadth and the height of it are equal. And he measured the wall thereof, 144 cubits, according to the measure of a man, that is, of the angel. And the building of the wall of it was of jasper, and the city was pure gold, like unto clear glass. And the foundations of the wall of the city were garnished with all manner of precious stones." Verse 21, "The 12 gates were 12 pearls. Every several gate was of one pearl, and the street of the city was pure gold, as it were transparent glass. And I saw no temple therein, for the Lord God Almighty and the Lamb are the temple of it. And the city had no need of the sun, neither of the moon to shine in it, for the glory of God did lighten it, and the Lamb is the light thereof." Verse 27, "There shall in no wise enter into it anything that defileth, neither whatsoever worketh abomination or maketh a lie, but they which are written in the Lamb's book of life. And he showed me a pure river of water of life, clear as crystal, proceeding out of the throne of God and of the Lamb. In the midst of the street of it, and on either side of the river, was the tree of life, which bare 12 manner of fruits, and yielded her fruit every month, and the leaves of the tree were for the healing of the nations. And there shall be no more curse, but the throne of God and of the Lamb shall be in it, and his servants shall serve him. And they shall see his face, and his name shall be in their foreheads, and there shall be no night there. And they need no candle, neither light of the sun, for the Lord God giveth them light, and they shall reign forever and ever." And the Lord will bless the reading of his word. Now, we often think as we approach this chapter, these chapters and this city, that if there were no broken hearts and weary pilgrims and lonely widows in the company. It might be very interesting to debate it, perhaps a little bit coldly. But since, of course, in every company there are those who are looking for something for the heart, what we want to do this evening is to look at this city in the very simple way that we have already mentioned on previous evenings. We want to be taking it this evening just as a little glimpse of the heavenly glory to which we are moving. Now, we have already said that we know that, strictly speaking, the city is not heaven. It does descend from God out of heaven, and strictly speaking, it is not heaven. But nevertheless, the glories of heaven are here. The glories of this Jerusalem are heavenly glories. And if my dear brethren sometimes disagree as to whether or not we ought to be looking at the eternal state or the millennium, or both the eternal state with our aversion to the millennium, it doesn't really matter in the end, for this reason, that we are engaged this evening with glories that are heavenly and glories that are eternal. So what we are looking at this evening is really just a little glimpse of heaven. Now, what I want to do, I'd like to divide my little message up into several parts with just a wee bit of alliteration. I'd like to look at the place, first of all, and there is a lovely description given of the place. We have to see that sometimes in the book of Revelation, there is a mixing of the literal with the symbolical. You say that's making it even more difficult. Sometimes it's difficult to distinguish which is literal and which is symbolic. Well, sometimes indeed we have something which is very literal and very real, but we have it described in symbolic language. For instance, there will be a real, actual battle at Armageddon. But you'll find that in several places this battle will be described in various ways. Indeed, the other evening we read from chapter 20, chapter 19, that this great battle is like a supper for the fowls of the air. In a great variety of ways that battle is described, but it is nevertheless a very real and a very literal carnage. So with other things in Revelation, there are things that are literal, but because of our finite minds, they have got to be described to us with language that is symbolical. And I believe that what we have here this evening is a literal dwelling place of the saints, but the description is, of course, symbolic. And if anyone doubts that the description is not literal, then that is very easily proven that it is symbolic, and we'll see that in a moment or two. So we want to look at the place, first of all, and at some of the descriptions that are given of the place. Now, although, again, strictly speaking, it might not be in the chapter, I want to have a little look at the people. I know that this chapter is not concerned with the populace of this city, but nevertheless, if there is a city, there is a citizenship, and it might be indeed that this is the most important aspect of the city, the people, the citizenship that actually makes the city. And I want to make one or two suggestions with regard to the people who are indeed the holy populace of this lovely city. Then, having seen the people, I want to come for a moment or two just to remind you of the purity of this place. There are lovely sentences, there is lovely language that describes the absolute purity. Indeed, it is a divine purity, and we shall see that in several places down the chapter, the purity of this city. I want then to come back and to have a look at the perfections of the place, and to see that the things that have made this old earth the sad place that it is, that these things will not be in the heavenly city, and that we are moving towards a scene where the old sad conditions of earth have passed away forever, and we shall arrive where there is perfection. We want to look at the perfections of the place. And then finally, I want to come to these verses with which we closed the reading, and to see something of the pleasures. We look forward to the pleasures of this lovely place, and these again are described in beautiful symbolical language. We want to see the pleasures of heaven itself. So then, we have the place and the people, and the purity and the perfections and the pleasures. And I trust that under these simple headings, we might be able to gather together the most of the scriptures that we have read this evening. Now, we are all of us interested in heaven. That makes the meeting, in a sense, a good deal easier. At least we are talking about something in which every one of us has an interest. We are all interested in heaven. I try to analyze, I try to think, why are we interested in heaven? And if you were to give your reasons for being interested in heaven, I wonder which would be your first reason. I think that the first reason ought to be that our Lord is there, and we are interested in the place where he is. He has gone up and he has gone in. He has gone in as a forerunner, something indeed that was entirely new, an entirely new concept for the Jewish mind, that a high priest should be a forerunner. You see, the high priest in the days of the tabernacle and the temple, he went where no one else could follow. But it's not like that with us. Our high priest is a forerunner, and he has gone up, and he has gone in, and we are following. So it might be that the first reason is that he is there, and the second reason is that we are going there. So it seems almost, I was going to say, a natural thing, that we should be interested in the place where he is, and that we should be interested in knowing what kind of place to which we ourselves are traveling. And then, of course, there is a third very precious reason, and it's a very tender and touching reason, and it is simply that most of us have friends who have already arrived there. I urge you not to say that they have gone, but that they have arrived. They have the advantage over us. They have arrived while we still make our way towards the glory. Many of our friends have arrived. Some of us have fathers there, and some have mothers, and some have partners. Some have both fathers and mothers, and partners too, and some have children. And there seems to be perhaps an obvious reason for our interest in heaven this evening, knowing that many of our friends have already arrived. Well, I trust that as we look at this lovely place, that it will not only help us, encourage us, and comfort us in regard to these things that we have mentioned, but I trust that it will do, as I remember a brother saying to me one evening after a meeting when we had talked about this chapter. He said to me, it makes earth a rather shabby place. And I trust that that's what will happen this evening, that we might indeed be just a little homesick for heaven, and that earth might become indeed a shabby place as we think of the glory to which we belong and to which we are traveling. Now, this lovely city, this holy, heavenly New Jerusalem, there are two great things that impress themselves upon me as I read this. If I were asked to read down these chapters and to just to give my impression, what is it, what sort of great sort of overall impression has come? I think that there are maybe three things altogether that would impress me about the city. I think that one thing, of course, would be the vastness of the city. And we're going to look indeed at the largeness of this place. And then the second thing would be its loveliness, its beauty. There is indeed a beauty here which is almost indescribable, really, to our little minds. But the beauty shines out. And when we see the great symbols that are used, say, in a symbol fashion to describe this beauty to us, I think the third great overall impression is the wealth, the richness of the city. These are three things that seem to be a kind of an overall general impression. There is largeness, and there is loveliness, and there is wealth, and there is all of these lovely things trying to impress themselves upon us, upon little minds that are really a little bit too small to take it all in. But at least in some measure this evening, I trust that we'll appreciate the vastness and the beauty and the wealth of this city. I think that maybe we have mentioned before, I mention it again for the sake of those that are younger, that there is an old saying in the world, and it ought never to go unchallenged, you know. Sometimes the world shrugs its shoulders when we talk about heaven, and they say, we can't know. Nobody can know. And nobody has been there and come back to tell us. You hear that over and over again in the world. And it's just not true, you know. And it ought not to go unchallenged, because you know that there are two men, at least two men, who have been and have come back. And from what they have seen and heard and what they have been able to tell us, we have an idea this evening of the kind of place that heaven is. So when they say in the world, no one has been and come back to tell us, it's just not true. The first man, you see, who was there was Paul. He was caught up, you remember. And if you count back from the time that he records it, I think he speaks about 14 years. And if you go back 14 years, you might well go back to that day when they stoned him one day and they left him thinking him dead. They left him on the road. And when he comes to write about it, he says, I don't know, he says, whether I was in the body or out of the body, I can't tell. But he says, I know that I was caught up into the third heaven, into paradise. He was caught right up into what the Hebrews epistle calls heaven itself, and he was caught up there into the glory, and now Paul has come back. And we mentioned perhaps in an earlier meeting that if you had gone to Paul, with what excitement you might have gone to him and said, Paul, you've been in the glory. Tell us what you saw. Tell us what you heard. But you would have been confronted with a rather silent Paul, because Paul would have said to you, look, he say, I just can't tell, he said. It's not, and sometimes we read it, it's not lawful. And sometimes we read it, it's not possible. And when you put the two things together, what Paul really is saying is this. He says, look, there is no law of grammar that makes it possible for me to tell. He said, I heard things up there that I can't repeat because I haven't got the language. I can't tell. You see, here is a man who was a linguist. You say with great surprise, you say, Paul, but you speak the beautiful Hebrew, the most picturesque language, this lovely Hebrew. Ah, he would say, there is nothing in Hebrew that allows me to tell what I heard, what I saw, what I experienced up there. And you say, Paul, you must be a master of Greek with all its niceties and with all its perfection of grammar. Can't you tell us in the Greek? And he would shake his head and tell you that there was no law of Greek grammar that allowed him to repeat what he had heard in the glory. And then you would say, well, Paul, what about the expressive Aramaic? And what about your Latin? And maybe indeed other language. Well, Paul would say, it might be that I have the privilege of speaking all of these, but there is no law of grammar, he says, that makes it possible for me to tell. It is not lawful. There is no law of language that makes it possible for me to describe. So you say, we're no further on. Well, now, you shouldn't say that too quickly, because I think we are a little bit further on. Because you see, even what we have learned from this is very beautiful. We have learned that, in fact, the glory there is indescribable. And the language is unrepeatable. We have learned that there is something there that cannot be grasped and that cannot be talked about in human language or with human minds. It is beyond description. So if Paul has been and come back and can't tell us, well, at least we have learned that the glory is indescribable. Well, then, after that, the fisherman is caught up, John. He's an old man now, and he's caught up into the heavens too. And you say, well, he's not the academic that Paul was. He's not the scholar. He's maybe indeed not the linguist that Paul might have been. And if Paul can't tell us, well, John can hardly tell us either. And John, of course, would agree entirely with his brother Paul that in a positive way, that place cannot be described. But what John will say to you, he say, I'm going to use symbolism. And of course, he does it under inspiration. He says, I'll use symbolism. And another thing he says, I'll describe it in a negative kind of way. He says, I'll talk about the things with which you are so familiar down here. And I tell you about a long list of things, he says, that are not there in the glory. They're not there. And if you and I, with our finite minds, can imagine a place where the sorrows of earth are no more, where all of these things that have made earth a sad place are things of the past, if we can imagine that, well, then John has succeeded under inspiration in describing in a negative way what cannot be described in a positive way. So when the world says, no one has been and come back to tell us, the world, as is very often, is wrong. And what we are seeing this evening is a description and symbol language given to us by a man who was there. Now you say, John, tell us about the size of this city. Well, we've got another problem, of course, and one of these problems that cannot be resolved, just can't be, and my brethren will be divided, maybe not equally divided, but they will be divided a wee bit about it this evening. You see, this city is 4 square. That means the length is as large as the breadth. But in some way or other, we've also got height to this city. Now, that proves, of course, that the language is symbolical because we don't measure the height of a city. But this is a vision of the glory, and John is describing it now in the symbol language, and he speaks about height. Now you say, therefore, that must be a cube. That's what I think, but that's not what all of my brethren think. Some think that, indeed, it might have been a pyramid shape that John was looking at. Now, you've got length and breadth and height to a pyramid, but the cube, you know, there's something special, something lovely about a cube. It really doesn't matter which way you look at a cube, it's always the same. There seems to be a sort of a perfection about it, a completeness about it, and there are many 4 square things in our Bible. Maybe the earliest of them is a 4 square altar, and we come right through to this 4 square city, and there is something special and perfect about a city which is 4 square every way. That is, it's got length and breadth and height, and therefore is a cubical city. Now, I don't know how your mathematics are, but John gives us a lot of zeros here. He says that the length and the breadth and the height, they were equal, and they were 12,000 furlongs. Now, 12,000 furlongs would be 1,500 miles, if they are furlongs as we know. And when you begin to find the cubic capacity of this city, you get a bit lost with the zeros, because it is 1,500 by 1,500 by 1,500 again. And if I count it right, it seems to me that we have about 3,500,000,000 cubic miles, and they are all filled with Christ in his glory. And that is the beauty of the city, the glory of the Lord Jesus, and the light of the Lamb filling up 3,500,000,000 cubic miles of this lovely city. Is it any wonder that we sing a little hymn sometimes? Millions have reached that blissful shore, their trials and their labors o'er, and yet there's room for millions more. This is a lovely place because of its vastness, 1,500 miles by 1,500 by 1,500 again. It is the largeness of this lovely city. Someone has calculated that, in fact, if this were only a flat surface, if it was simply 1,500 by 1,500, that even then we have got a territory which is as large as Britain and France and Spain and Italy and Germany and the half of Russia. All of that, 1,500 miles by 1,500 miles. This is a large place. I wouldn't want you to be occupied with these numbers in a literal way. I don't think that they are here. I think that what we can see is the repetition of the number 12, and we'll see that again and again, and all my brethren agree about this, that the number 12 is ever the number that is associated with government and with administration. And here in this lovely city, there is a perfection of administration and of government, but it is the vastness of the place that immediately appeals to me. Now, John comes to a little bit of detail about the place, and he says there was a wall there, and there were gates there, and there was a street there, and he begins now with his symbol language to describe the beauty of these parts of the city. He says the wall of this city, and you notice the number 12 again, he says it was 144 cubits, that's 12 twelves now again, 144 cubits high, and this wall was of solid jasper. Now, you remember, of course, that earlier in the book of Revelation, we have the jasper in association with the throne, way back in chapter 4. And when John saw the glory there that could not be described, this is one of the impressions that he had, that it was like the beauty of the jasper. But this apparently is not the opaque jasper that we might know, but rather a kind of a translucent jasper with the light shining through it. And if you try to picture a wall, now this wall therefore must be at least 6,000 miles. It's right around the city, and it's 1,500 miles four times. So you've got 6,000 miles of solid, beautiful, precious jasper, 144 cubits high. And you think of the wealth of that, and you begin to compare it with the precious stones that men know today. I understand that the most valuable stone today is in Russia somewhere, and they tell me that it would lie in the palm of an infant's hand, that you could put it into the hand of a baby and let the little infant fingers go round it. And I can't tell you the value because it's priceless, you see. And then there are other precious stones too. But here we have a city, and the very wall of the city is 6,000 miles of jasper, and you can imagine the light of the glory shining through this jasper. Now, the height of the city is very interesting, and brethren have long pointed out that there are two sides to every story and two ways of looking at this wall. Now, 144 cubits, and if you take it as being about 21 inches, it means that you have a wall about 250 feet high, approximately. Now, 250 feet, you say, this is a tremendous wall. And you know, as I approach this wall as a puny mortal, just as a poor human, in all my weakness and puniness, I stand before it, and as I look up 250 feet high, oh, but you say, God has raised this barrier very high, 250 feet, and here we stand, and we have a sense of our own weakness and our own smallness as we think of the height of the wall that is around the city. But there are two sides to every story. And if you relate the size of this wall, not to the mortal that stands before it, but if you relate it to the height of the city, then a wall of 250 feet around about a city which is 1,500 miles high, that's now a very different proportion of things. And it means, in fact, that it's something like a tiny little fence of only maybe a fraction of an inch around an average-sized dwelling house today. And you say, well, you couldn't really bring it down any lower than that. No, I don't think that you could. You see, there is a righteousness and a holiness of God which keeps coming up again and again in the book of Revelation, as we have seen, and it is that holiness that has raised the barrier very, very high. But then, of course, there is wondrous grace and there is divine love that seems to have brought the wall down as low as possible. And then the whole thing is beauty and glory. I remind you again that it is solid jasper and that the glory of the city, the glory of the Lamb, is shining through it. Then John comes to tell us that there are gates in this wall, and he places them, you know, very impartially. He says there were three gates on the east, there were three on the north, there were three in the south and three in the west. And who can read about these 12 gates on the north and the south and the east and the west without thinking of what the Lord Jesus said when he said, you know, they'll come from the north and the south. They'll come from the east and the west, and they'll sit down in that day in the glory, and we'll see what kind of people will be there in a moment or two. But here is that impartiality of God that somehow places the gates alike equally in every wall, in every aspect of the city, so that from all parts they will eventually come, and to all parts the glory will flow out. So the gates are placed according to the character of God himself. They are placed impartially, absolutely. Now, if you want proof that the description is symbolical, Well, you come to have a look at the material out of which these gates are made. And John says, every gate was one pearl. Now, you'll never make that literal. You've got to make that symbolic. Every single gate is a giant pearl. Every respective gate is a pearl, one pearl. And what a lovely sight that must have been. There is something about the pearl, you know. The pearl is never mentioned in the Old Testament. And if you say, well, in my reading, I think I have read of it somewhere, well, you probably have read the word once, but if you have a closer look and check it up indeed with my brethren, you'll discover that it is not the ordinary, usual word for pearl. And probably, indeed, it ought to be translated diamond or crystal or something like that. It is not the ordinary pearl that is mentioned once in the Old Testament. So that when we come now to the New Testament, we find the pearl introduced. And there is something very special about a pearl for this reason. That men, you know, can cut the diamond. They can do it very skillfully. It is, by the way, though perhaps it's not a very relevant thing, but it's an interesting thing, that it is today Israel's chief source of income. Diamond cutting. And they pride themselves, not mining diamonds, but cutting them. And from all parts of the world, they bring the uncut diamonds to Israel. And along that Mediterranean coast, you find them cutting the diamonds very skillfully. Now, what they do, of course, they cut the facets off. They cut the pieces, the sides. Very skillfully they do it, so that in a variety of angles, the light is caught and reflected. And we get all this beauty. You can see something of the skill of man when you look at a diamond. And the same, perhaps, with other stones. But when you come to the pearl, man has done nothing with it, nor can he do anything with it. It is, as has often been said, it is the product of a wounded side. Somewhere down in the depths, a foreign body has lodged itself in the flesh of this little organism on the ocean bed. And the answer to this wound in the side of the oyster is that it wraps a layer of nacre that we call mother of pearl. It wraps this layer around this wounding, this offending particle. And then it wraps another layer and another and another and another until eventually someone brings it up from the ocean bed. And when they open the shell, here is the pearl with all its unique preciousness and beauty. And man has had no part in it. It is the product of a wounded side. When we reach these pearly gates, the only boast that we shall have is the blood of Christ. We shall say, He died for me. We shall sing it, I was a guilty sinner, but Jesus died for me. And the product of His wounded side is this, that there are 12 pearly gates in this lovely city. Had there been no Calvary, had there been no wounded side, then there would have been no admission, not for any of us, into this scene of glory. So there is a vastness, there is a beauty, there is a wealth in the wall, and then these gates that we have mentioned, and then we come to the street. Now, the street is in the singular. And I frankly can't think of a hymn that mentions this street that does not put it into the plural. And the hymns all sing about the golden streets of heaven. But the word, in fact, is a singular word. It is a street. And I wonder, why should it be in the singular? Well, you know, the cities in which we live, the cities with which we have become familiar, they are most of them a maze of streets. And streets can be very divisive of people into classes and into kinds. I know that where I live, you've only got to ask a man, where do you live? And once he tells you the street where he lives, you can tell a lot about that man. You can tell what strata of society he belongs to. You can maybe tell where he moves on a Sunday. You can tell so many things about the man, if only you know the street he's living in. So many things. But when we get home here to all this glory, there is a street in the singular. And John says the street is pure gold. It is like crystal. It is clear as crystal. And it is as pure as gold. And you'll notice, of course, the heavenly character coming out again. This gold was at that time the most precious thing that men knew. And here is this most precious metal that is used to describe the very streetway upon which we shall walk. We shall stand that day upon the strength and the glory of the divine promises and the divine character. We shall rest upon it so that you stand back and you look at this city. Pearly gates, jasper wall, golden street, crystal, gold, and the foundations of the wall of it, pebble dashed with all manner of precious stones. I couldn't tell you what is the detailed symbolism here. I only know that there is a variety of glory, and it seems to me that what is happening is that the light of the glory is being broken up in an almost interminable way. Such a variety of stones that are being used to sort of break up the light and let us see the beauty of it. You see, light in itself, we really can't appreciate it unless it is broken up. But when one day we go out and we see the rainbow and we look at all these colors, we admire them and we say that this is the light really broken up into seven parts, and we can appreciate it now, the various components, if you like, of this light. And maybe this is a thought here, that when the glory shines through this jasper and we see it reflecting and shining through these stones with which the foundations of the wall of the city are actually pebble dashed, that the light is broken up into an endless variety of beauties, of colors and hues. Here is glory that now we can in some little measure admire and wonder at it and appreciate it. And so the whole thing is vastness and wealth and beauty, loveliness and glory. John says, I'll describe it in a negative way or in a symbolic way. Paul says, I haven't got language that allows me to tell. Now the people of the city are not specifically mentioned in this chapter, but it would be wrong to think of a city and not to think for a moment or two of the citizenship. And what an illustrious list of names we have when we begin to think of the people that are the holy populace of this lovely city. I find it interesting sometimes to conduct a little exercise with some of my brethren. I say, look, make a little list of the people that you look forward to meeting when you get to the glory. And I'll make a list too. And it's very interesting to compare the lists. You see, we're going to home to meet the most illustrious people that ever walked here on earth, and now they're in glory. And they're going to be our company. And of course, before you get to the human society, you remember that divine persons are here. God and the Lamb. 'Tis well, I know that source divine. God is here. The Lamb, divine persons. Oh, to think of wondrous grace, that I shall dwell with divine persons one day, and be, as Paul says, at home. You know very well that that word is found only once in 2 Corinthians 5. It's a pity that the translator said, absent from the body and present with the Lord. Because it's not the whole thought. It's absent from the body, at home with the Lord. I think it's Mr. Vine who says about that word that it means to be with one's own folks, at home. It's not just a house. It's to be at home. And to think that one day I shall be at home where divine persons are. That is a wondrous thought. Well, might we sing this evening, and is it so? We shall be like thy son. And here is a city where divine persons are, and where there are others at home in the presence of these persons. I wouldn't be too black and white and restricted about places in the eternal state. And what I mean is confining certain peoples to a new earth and certain peoples to a new heaven and certain peoples to the heavenly city. Don't restrict them too much, because you're into an eternal state which is entirely different to all the restrictiveness that we have known down here. So that what I can see is this, that we shall no doubt be often in the presence of angelic beings. Maybe in that day, we shall know the difference between cherubim and seraphim. And what a tremendous thought that we shall not only be there in the company of these holy beings, but that in fact we shall be actually closer to the Lamb than they are. But then you come to look at the list of those that were mortal. I think of the patriarchs. How would your list begin? No doubt with Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. And God himself several times over calls himself the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. These men meant much to him. We shall see them in the glory. We come through the line of prophets. And I hope it's not just human sentimentality that some of us will look forward very specially to meeting Isaiah. We shall bless him for what we have come to call chapter 53. It will be nice to talk it over in the glory with men like that. Some of you, unlike some of the rest of us, you may be more familiar with the men that we have maybe irreverently called the minor prophets. But they'll be there too. We shall see them. We think of men like Daniel. We think of some of the kings who prophesied like David. The psalmists, the poets. We think of these great men. Oh, we have known the writings, and maybe we have become familiar with the men as we have looked at their writings. And to think that they shall be our companions is a wonderful thought. We come through that long line of interesting persons and cross over the silent years between the Testaments and come into the New Testament. I think it will be interesting in those days to meet the Marys and to know indeed in that day, for with some definiteness, whether there were 6 or 7 or 8 of them, and to be able to distinguish and to get to know them, the Marys who were very precious to the Lord. I think of all the men of the New Testament. Perhaps Paul was a very privileged man. No doubt so was John, as were the rest of the apostles. But if I were asked to make a fine distinction, I think I would look forward to talking to another man who was not mentioned very much, to the man Joseph of Arimathea. What a privileged man he was. Is it possible, brethren, that we shall be in the glory and spend eternity and not find some little while to talk to a man like Joseph of Arimathea? In what language will you talk? I don't know. But surely we shall be able to commune and to converse and to recall again those tender moments when he took the holy body down from the tree. What a privileged man he was. And we'd come on down through the New Testament, and you would list men and women, and I would list men and women. And then we would come out of the New Testament, and we'd list the men of those early ages and the men of the Middle Ages. We'd list some of those that wrote lovely hymns for us that we have enjoyed singing. You'd come down through the Puritans and through that story of the evangelists of the great evangelical awakening of that last century. And it might be that for a good deal of this time, our lists would run together very similar. But then, of course, we'd come to the tail end of the list. We think of men that we have known who have helped us. You'd come down through the Puritans and through that story of the evangelists of the great evangelical awakening of that last century. And it might be that for a good deal of this time, our lists would run together very similar. But then, of course, we'd come to the tail end of the list. We think of men that we have known who have helped us. Now they're gone. We think of mothers and fathers that have taught us, and they're gone. We think of those that we have loved, and for a little while they have left us, and we look forward to meeting them again. Shall we know them? What a foolish question. It doesn't warrant debate. Of course we shall know them. Not by physical features, not by physical appearance, but we shall know them. By moral features and character, we shall know them. And we look forward to meeting our friends again. I lost my mother when she was very young, and I was very young. She was 38, and I was 11. My brother was 8. And after a couple of years of illness, she left us in the early hours of one morning. And her last words were to her sister, "Look after the boys. I'm redeemed. Redeemed." I went with my father a little while afterwards. He was ordering a stone for the top of the grave. And I was still very young, but I remember so vividly him saying to the sculptor, No, he said, just one word. Just the one word. Redeemed. Redeemed. I couldn't understand it fully. I learned afterwards it was her favorite word. I'd heard her often sing that lovely word, redeemed, how I love to proclaim it. But what I know now is this, that the whole redemption has not been enjoyed yet. How right she was to say, "I'm redeemed, and then to close her eyes and to leave us. But the whole story's not been told yet. One day, she'll hear the shout with her other friends who have gone. And he will come to redeem the possession that he has purchased. And he will take them home with us. And we'll people this heavenly city. And we'll make it resound with praise. And we'll sing the glory of the Lamb in this lovely city. And such is the purity of this place that the gates are guarded. There is crystal holiness. There is nothing that defiles will ever enter in. And in that place they will cry forever, "Holy, holy, holy." Nothing that defileth will ever enter in here. We shall be at home where sin will be no more. The purity of the city is described. I think in the crystal-like appearance of the city. The whole city looked, says John, as if it was pure gold, like transparent glass. And everything reflected in everything else. Everything bearing the very likeness of the divine character. The glory abounding everywhere. And all these lovely people at home with the Lord. Now John says, Paul is right. You can't describe it positively. But he says, let me tell you what's not there. He says, there's no curse. There's no sea. There's no pain. There's no sorrow, there's no crying, no tears, no death, no night, no sun, no moon, no candle, no temple. All of these things that were known on earth, they're things of the past now, they're gone. No curse. That's like Eden restored again. Indeed it is. And more. No curse. Very, very difficult for you and for me to imagine a place where there are no evidences of the curse anymore. But that's how it is here. The curse is gone. And there's no sea. And the symbolism here is simple. I've told you again and again that if the symbol's not explained here, well, it'll be explained there, somewhere else. You've only got to search. And you know, over and over and over again in symbolism, the sea is a picture of the restlessness of nations, casting up mire and dirt. The wicked are like the troubled sea that cannot rest. It is these democratic nations, a democracy that goes on and on in a kind of an insatiable restlessness that eventually will end in anarchy, as we have seen already. Democracy was never the mind of God. So here, there is no more of this. No more sea. Oh, there's no restlessness now. There is the settled sovereignty of the throne. The sea has gone. And if you like to look at the sea in that other way, and to see it as that great enemy that has separated friends and families, well, you look at it that way if you wish, and there's no more sea when we get here. There's no pain. No pain. Some of you find that hard to believe. You find it hard to understand. One of the dear men that helped me when I was a young believer was a man who lay for 8 years with every limb, every joint locked with a most cruel form of arthritis. And for 8 years he lay locked like that, moving nothing but his head. And you know, for 8 years, he never had a moment free of pain. And some days were worse than others. And some days we'd go to see him. And we'd say, "Harry, how are you today?" And he would say, "It will be nice to get home, brethren. No more pain. Now he's home. No sorrow." In every company of the Lord's people, there are broken hearts. In every company. What causes your sorrow may be different to what causes mine. But there is a sadness in every household, a sad heart in every meeting. But when we get home, there's no sorrow. No crying. No tears. We have seen in an earlier meeting that in almost every book in our Bible there is a reference to weeping, beginning with the tears of those mothers, the tears of Hagar, and the mothers of the New Testament, weeping for their boys. And all through our Bible, we have found tears weeping over and over and over again. Kings and prophets and apostles and the Lord himself and his people weeping over and over again. And it's hard for us to imagine that we shall be one day where there are no more tears. And you know, God shall wipe away all tears from their eyes. That's not even the best way to say it. That's a wee bit too general. The more accurate way to read it is this, that God shall wipe away every tear. As if he is taking notice of every single tear his people shed. And he'll wipe away every tear in that day. We had an old couple in a meeting in Belfast who had lived together as husband and wife devoted for many, many, many years. And to this day, brethren will tell you about the evening that she passed away. And he sat and held her hand. Her name was Mary. And brethren who were there with him, waiting, watching for the end, they will tell you how. That when she closed her eyes and breathed her last, there was just one tear that sort of came from under her lid, onto her cheek. Just one tear. And the old man gently wiped it away with the corner of his handkerchief. And they heard him say, "That's the last one, Mary." Every tear gone. No death. No death. Do you know the kind of world we have lived in? We have actually maintained life by feeding on death. That's an amazing thing. We have maintained life by feeding on death all these years of our pilgrimage. One day we shall arrive where there is no death. And there's no night. But although there's no night, there's no sun to be offensive and oppressive. And although there's no sun, and there's no moon, there is no candle, there's no torch, there's no need for artificial light. Because you see, the glory of Christ lights this place. There are no less than 7 references to the Lamb in the description of the Holy City. Look for them sometime. And it seems that the Lamb is everywhere. He's in its foundation. He's in its register. He's connected with its river. He is its light. He is its joy. The worship is directed towards him and through him. and the government is from the throne of the Lamb. It seems that everything is connected with the Lamb, and the Lamb is the light of this lovely place. There's no sun, no moon, and no candle, no lamp, no torch. Now, there's no temple. Oh, says someone, I would have thought that there would have been a temple in a holy place like this. Well, of course, you see, God only needs a temple where there is sin. And when away back in those early days, he looked down, he said to his people, he said, build me a sanctuary. I want to dwell among you, but I need a sanctuary. I need a place. I can't dwell anywhere in that kind of world. Build me a sanctuary. So they built a tabernacle, and later they built a temple. And today he dwells in his people. And when the Lord Jesus was here, he was resident, all the glory of deity resident in that lovely body. But now, we come to a city here where there is no sin, no defilement, no iniquity here. God doesn't need a temple. He can dwell here. Divine persons dwell here with great complacency. No temple. No temple needed because there is no sin. These are the perfections of this lovely city. The pleasures are these: a crystal river, a tree of life. There is, in these opening verses of chapter 22, well, just so many things that can be called pleasures of this lovely place. There is an unwearied service here. His servants shall serve him. There is a likeness to him which will be unspoiled. His name shall be on their foreheads. We shall be like him. There is unchallenged rule here because the throne is here. There is health here that will never be diminished. The leaves of the tree are for the health of the nations. There is unfading light here. There is unending day. There is unparalleled glory. There are pleasures here that are untold. But if I were to ask my brethren to choose one pleasure from out of the list that is given here, I would expect that so many of them would point me to those simple but beautiful words: they shall see his face. Here is the greatest delight, that we shall look upon him. We have loved him for years without seeing him. But in this city, we shall see his face. Oh, to be able to look upon him, to converse and commune and adore in a way that was not possible down here, and to look upon this lovely face, the face, mind you, of which we have read in the gospel meeting, from whose face the earth and the heavens fled away. But we shall not flee. We shall be at home in his presence, and they shall see his face, says John. And we shall be like him, and they shall reign forever and ever, forever and ever. We shall share his glory. I don't care, brethren, whether you read the first 9 verses of chapter 21 and then decide that you've got to revert to the millennium. I hope you don't make it a bigger problem than it is. For this reason, that the glories of this city are eternal glories. And whether you are viewing it in its eternal state, in its relation to the millennium, the glories are just the same. And we shall reign forever and ever. And if you do, and I hope you do, see a millennium, 1,000 years of reign down here, don't forget that the kingdom is everlasting. It is the everlasting kingdom of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. And the word of the angel will be fulfilled. He shall reign for forever and ever. That's what the angel said, announcing his birth. Of his kingdom there shall be no end. It goes on and on. The earthly phase of it may come to an end, but the glory, the kingdom itself, goes on and on. I hope that we become homesick for heaven, and that while we wait for him, waiting to be caught up to be with him, I trust that we keep ourselves separate and apart from all that would defile and grieve him. May the Lord help us to live for him. Shall we pray?